Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Anthony Brooks. An Acton family is waiting for a decision from Middlesex Superior Court on whether the words "under God" should be removed from the Pledge of Allegiance recited daily in that town's schools.
Specifically, the part that says America is one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
That's right. The family, which has chosen to remain anonymous, says that part of the pledge discriminates against their children, whom they are raising as atheists.
And if you're experiencing some deja vu, it's because this issue has come up before in other courts around the country. But attorneys for the Acton family are taking a new legal approach that could change the way the pledge is recited across Massachusetts. Lawyer David Niosi spoke to us earlier from his office in Fitchburg.
David, I imagine that a lot of parents get irked about their kids reciting the "under God" portion of the pledge. What can you tell us about why this family took that extra leap of suing their kids' school system?
Well, they just thought it was important enough. It's a matter of discrimination, and it's time to bring it to the forefront.
The superintendent has said that these kids and others are already free to just sit out the pledge if they want to, or to amend it, or to leave out the words "under God," or do whatever they wish. Why aren't these solutions adequate for the family that you're representing?
Well, voluntariness really has nothing to do with it. The school is conducting an official exercise that is discriminating against them. The pledge is a serious patriotic exercise. It's indoctrinational by definition, really. And I don't say that in a bad way. I mean, by indoctrinational, we're really defining patriotism and we're teaching our kids what it means to be an American. These kids go to school for 13 years, and every single day they're required to go in and be faced with an exercise that defines patriotism by excluding them. I don't think anyone could deny that the pledge, as currently worded, strongly implies that if you are not a true believer, you're not quite up to par as far as patriotism goes.
David, there have been similar lawsuits in other parts of the country, most famously the one brought by a father named Michael Newdow in California. His case went all the way to the Supreme Court, which dismissed it on a technicality. But the Ninth Circuit in California more recently upheld the constitutionality of "under God" based on the actual merits of the case. They said that it does not violate the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment that says Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of a religion, provided that reciting the "under God" portion of the pledge is voluntary. What makes your case any different?
Well, what makes it different is that ours is not an Establishment Clause case.
I see.
The Newdow cases, or basically Establishment Clause cases, the argument that we're bringing forth is not an Establishment Clause argument at all. It's an equal protection argument.
I see.
The case is brought under the Equal Rights Amendment of the Massachusetts Constitution because for too long, atheists and other non-theistic religions have not been given the advantage of equal rights protection. And I think the Establishment Clause in some ways distracts from the issue of equal rights. The Massachusetts Constitution, unlike the federal Constitution, expressly protects religious minorities. It says that discrimination against anyone on the basis of religion is unconstitutional. So it's very strong language. If it should protect anyone, it should protect a religious minority that is being subjected to daily discrimination through a pledge exercise.
We're hearing that a decision is due in a week. What are you expecting will happen?
We're certainly hoping that it comes our way. It's a pretty straightforward case, really.
Is it likely to go straight to the state Supreme Court?
Yes, we think it has a good chance of going there. The definition of what religious equality means has really not been adjudicated. So,
the fact that this is a challenge that is based on state law, does that mean that we wouldn't see this case ever going into the federal courts as we have seen in the Newdow case?
That's right. This is a state court challenge under the state constitution of a state statute. So there's really no federal question involved. The pledge, of course, does have a federal statute that sets its wording. In fact, the pledge was changed in 1954 to add the under God language. So what we're really saying is that just because the federal government added religious language to the pledge back in 1954 at the height of the McCarthy era, that does not mean that the state should require daily recitation of that pledge in its public schools.
That's Attorney David Nyosi. He's representing an Acton family who are suing their school district to have the words under God removed from the Pledge of Allegiance. And he's right, of course, about that part being a relatively new addition to the pledge. Interestingly, state law in Massachusetts only mandates that school kids say the pledge. It does not explicitly say which version of the pledge they're supposed to say. And that could affect how this all shakes out in the courts. Here's what we want to hear from you, listeners. If you were in school in 1954 when the pledge was changed, or maybe if you were teaching school and you remember what that was like, call us right now. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. If you were in school in 1954 when the words under God were added to the Pledge of Allegiance here in Massachusetts or anywhere else in the country, call in right now. Did it seem noteworthy to you at all? What did the other kids or the other grown-ups think? Were they enthusiastic? Did anyone raise an eyebrow? We'd love to get a couple of memories on 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us on the line right now is Professor Stephen Green. He's the director of the Center for Religion, Law, and Democracy at Willamette University in Oregon, and he's also a historian of the pledge. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
You're talking to a Boston audience here, but you know something that they should know, and I suspect many of them don't. The first version of the pledge was written right here toward the end of the 19th century. Tell us about Francis Bellamy.
Well, Francis Bellamy is an interesting person. He was a Baptist socialist, or a socialist Baptist, which sounds like the epitome of an oxymoron today. But actually, it was not that unusual back then. Back in the latter part of the 19th century, of course, was the time of the social gospel. And Francis Bellamy was relatively liberal in his political, social outlook. And he had worked in tenements and actually had a very hard time holding down a Baptist church there in Boston. And so he was invited or was hired by a very popular magazine at the time. I don't think it has been around for a long time, called Youth's Companion. And this was a magazine that promoted character of children. And he was hired right about the time that there was a drive that went underway at the time to provide flags in all public schools.
Mm-hmm.
And so in conjunction with this, they created kind of a contest for patriotic essays from children to bring these in. And this was actually coinciding with the 1892 Columbian Exposition, which was the 400th anniversary of Columbus's discovery of America. And so consequently, there's a lot of kind of patriotic stuff going on at the time. And so to provide a context for these ceremonies, then Bellamy, on the request of his editor, came up with a pledge. And initially, you're right, the pledge was somewhat different than it is today. It says, I pledge allegiance to my flag and to the republic for which it stands, one nation indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, so that went by a little fast for some listeners, but let's just take note of the fact that there are two things that they were probably expecting that they didn't hear. They didn't hear under God, and the other thing they didn't hear was United States.
No, they didn't, yeah. And it was my flag, not the flag.
Yeah.
And so it was an attempt by Bellamy to create some kind of relationship with the flag among the children, to instill patriotism to them.
So it was published in Youth's Companion magazine. I should mention for the listeners here that the Youth's Companion building where the magazine was based at the time is still there. Some people call it the Pledge of Allegiance building. It's in the Back Bay at the corner of Berkeley and Columbus. There's a Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams furniture store on the ground floor, as well as a club cafe is there. You can still go and see it. Let's also take note of something that might have gone by a little too fast for the listeners, which is that the Pledge of Allegiance was written by a socialist.
Mm-hmm. It's actually really interesting. He was a complex man. He had a kind of a speaking stunt speech where he actually would go out and talk about how Jesus Christ was a socialist. And Bellamy believed in, he disliked capitalism. He disliked the materialism associated with capitalism. And so he didn't go quite so far as redistribution of wealth. But he really believed that we needed to be more of an egalitarian nation. At the same time, though, he believed very strongly in patriotism, and he believed very strongly that we needed to instill patriotism in young children. And he was somewhat concerned about the growing immigration and the assimilation of foreign children in kind of into the American experience. So these were all parts of the mix of why he wrote the Pledge of Allegiance.
To what extent did he conceive of the pledge as what I think we take it to be in the modern age, which is a loyalty oath?
He really didn't see it as a loyalty oath. It was more of trying to, again, instill patriotism in children, but not some type of test. We can kind of debate what Bellamy would have wanted. I don't think anybody can say for sure, but that really wasn't the thrust of what was going on back then to make it into something of an oath. And actually, oaths had somewhat of a bad history, and it would be surprising to think that he would have supported it as some type of mandatory oath.
Tell us about the Bellamy salute.
Well, this is what's really interesting. Actually, one of the reasons that Congress finally codified the pledge in 1942, of course, during the middle of World War II, mm-hmm. was that there were so many versions of the pledge floating around out there, and then also so many different types of salutes that were connected to the pledge. Some were just like, you know, salutes like a military person would have, you know, to the top of their hat. There was one salute that actually looks something like it's more from Star Trek, where you hold your arm up, you know, horizontal, kind of in a, you know, you're greeting someone from a...
Yeah, me,
planet.
Gorg, you, human, right. Yeah,
that type of thing. But one of the more popular versions of the salute prior to World War II was a salute that looked very, very similar to the Nazi salute, with a hand raised at an angle with a palm, in that case, actually flat as opposed to directly out. And that was actually what most of the salutes were in the public schools during that period of time, was this very similar Nazi salute.
Yeah, whoops.
That quickly changed.
Yeah. Tell us briefly, take us into the 1950s when Under God gets added.
Well, it was kind of part of a general transition. You had actually some cases that came up in World War II that dealt with Jehovah's Witnesses who refused to, the children refused to say the pledge, and this is before you had the in God put in, Under God put in the pledge itself. But back in the 1950s, early 1950s, of course, everybody is somewhat familiar with what was going on then. We had the Korean War erupt. We had the Red Scare. And to a certain extent, Joseph McCarthy kind of set the tone by giving a talk back, I think it was in 1950, where he actually said he set up this statement that there was this inevitable and ultimate battle that was looming between godless communism or communist atheism and Western Christianity. And so he set up this kind of dualistic situation that we were the God-fearing people and communism was what was evil and godless. So at that point in time, the American Legion launched what was called a Back to God campaign to try to increase public awareness of God in our daily lives and kind of a public representation of God. And so that got things kind of rolling. Actually, in 1955, you saw the addition of In God We Trust on the paper money, which is probably something that most people don't realize how recent invention that is. So this was all going on. In 1953, the Knights of Columbus, a Catholic fraternal organization, actually spearheaded a drive. Initially, they had sent out a kind of a marching order, so to speak, to their own members for them to insert Under God in the pledge when they said it in their private meetings. This caught on, and so they started lobbying Congress to amend the pledge and put in something that referred to God.
And Congress heard, and Eisenhower signed it.
Yeah, Congress heard, and actually the story is that on Lincoln's birthday in 1954, that President Eisenhower and his wife were in a church, New York Avenue Presbyterian Church there in Washington, D.C., and the minister gave a sermon deploring the lack of a religious acknowledgement in the Pledge of Allegiance and how that we were going to be running towards secularism and relativism if we didn't do something. And so once Eisenhower got on board, Congress got behind it not that they needed much nudging at that point.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And so it was signed into law on Flag Day, June 14th, 1954.
And I asked our listeners earlier if any of them remembered the pledge getting changed while they were in school, and we have a few of them here. Paul from Hudson is first. Paul, you were 8 years old?
Yeah, I think so. If I do my arithmetic right, I think I was in the third grade. Of course, I had learned the pledge before then, and so this was a change. I'm pretty sure we said the pledge in school every day. And it stood out because of this change. Why this change? You know, at the time, you know, as a kid, you know, I went to church with my parents and, you know, whatever. You know, so, I mean, I don't think it bothered me particularly then, but as time went on, I became less of a believer, I guess, and it stuck in my craw more every time until I just stopped saying it, you know, and I'd skip that part.
You skipped that part in the 1950s?
You know, at least in the 60s.
Yeah. I'm impressed, Paul. Thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Bill from Bedford. Bill, you remember when they added Under God to the Pledge of Allegiance?
I do. I was an 11-year-old Boy Scout at the time. And as with Paul, certainly I said the pledge every day in school, and when they added the words, it did seem a little strange. But on the other hand, it wasn't strange in the Boy Scouts because God is always, back then at least, was always part of their programs.
And still is, yeah.
They had a God and Country Award, which was, I think still exists, that they hand out for religious studies. And so it was very much supported by the Boy Scout leaders. And also we were told just what your guest has said, which was that this was to prove that we were different and probably better than the communists, who we all knew were those nasty people on the other side of the world.
How did that strike you at the time, Bill?
At the time, it just, at 11-year-old, you pretty much take your lead from your adults,
right.
And the adults thought it was a good idea, so I didn't have any contrary thoughts to it. I'm not sure with all our money saying God we trust, it really is that much different.
Bill, I appreciate your call. Professor Stephen Green at Willamette University, do you have an opinion on whether or not Under God is constitutional and should remain in the pledge?
I think it depends on the context, and the context here, of course, is in the public school classroom.
Sure.
And the Supreme Court has been extremely concerned and cautious about forms of religious instruction in public schools and religious affirmations as such. And particularly if you're talking about kind of a coercive classroom environment, that I think it might be quite difficult for a child, notwithstanding that the laws provide that it be voluntary, still it would be really hard for a child not to participate. In the case that was recently decided by the First Circuit out there in Boston, out of New Hampshire, that law provided that a child did not have to participate, but the options given to the child were either to remain seated when his classmates were not, or stand and be silent.
Mm-hmm.
But the child couldn't leave the classroom. And the pressure that I think a child would feel to participate in that might be relatively coercive.
Yeah, very similar to the argument against prayer in schools, voluntary or involuntary. Professor, just in the last minute that we have here, you know, we're living in a globalized era. We're all more independent and interconnected to our brothers and sisters in other nations than ever before. Do you think that there's any relevance or need for a national loyalty oath in the 21st century?
I actually don't. I specialize in First Amendment law, and so I'm kind of concerned about that. And my sense is that this was something actually that the founders were very much opposed to. They actually thought that oaths don't do what they're supposed to do, that the person who is not going to be able to swear an oath or is not going to be loyal will have no compulsion about lying. And it's not going to be very effective. And so it's, in some ways, it's kind of inconsistent with our general belief in liberty of conscience.
Well, there it is. Professor Stephen Green, he's the director of the Center for Religion, Law, and Democracy at Willamette University in Salem, Oregon. Professor, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, listeners, stay with us. Coming up, Massachusetts is a leader in private higher education, but sometimes that means people overlook our state's flagship public university. We'll talk with the new president of the University of Massachusetts about the challenges facing that institution. I'm Adam Ragusea with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.